Welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Leila Nathu. As confusion surrounds the prospect of talks between Washington and Tehran over a possible end to the war, could Iran's parliamentary speaker play a key role?
He's a serious type, and he has also been a serious politician. He's well-liked. Many Iranian women even think that he's a good-looking gentleman. He's a blonde with green eyes.
We also ask why Pakistan thinks it can mediate between the two sides. Also on the programme, the AI company Anthropic versus the Pentagon, pregnant women in Cuba feeling the strain of President Trump's fuel blockade on the island, and rescue.
Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Federal investigators are reviewing flight data recorders from the Air Canada jet that collided with a fire truck at LaGuardia Airport Sunday night. Two pilots were killed. Dozens of people were injured. National Transportation Safety Board Chair Jennifer Homendy tells Fox News they want to know more about how the fire truck was directed onto the runway.
They have a lot of questions for air traffic control. Everything from workload at the time, who was communicating, who was in the tower cab, who was in the facility, what the changeover was like for the new shift, which is the midnight shift. We have questions about communications and that will be revealed on the cockpit voice recorder, which we were able to recover, and the flight data recorder.
LaGuardia Airport has reopened to traffic, but it is very slow. The Federal Aviation Administration is warning airline passengers their flights could be delayed by well over 4 hours. Lebanon's health ministry says an Israeli airstrike has killed at least three people southeast of Beirut. Israel says it's targeting Iran-backed Hezbollah militants, but human rights groups say the response is disproportionate. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from Beirut.
Israel has ordered evacuation orders for huge swaths of Lebanon, and about a fifth of the population has been displaced. But this strike southeast of the capital came without warning. Footage shows flames and smoke billowing from a residential building. This week, Israel's defense minister threatened to use on Lebanon the, quote, Gaza model, which razed many residential areas, and said he's accelerating the destruction of Lebanese homes in border villages, from which Hezbollah has fired rockets. Human Rights Watch says forcible displacement and attacks deliberately targeting civilians are war crimes. Israel has also struck gas stations across Lebanon that are known to have business ties with Hezbollah. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Beirut.
Stocks opened lower this morning as oil prices have rebounded. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slid about 280 points in early trading.
Oil prices are climbing again as intense bombardment continues from Tehran to Tel Aviv. AAA says the average price of retail gasoline has jumped to $3.98 a gallon. That's up a dollar since the war began. Diesel prices have jumped by nearly $1.60 a gallon. The head of the International Energy Agency says the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran poses a, quote, major threat to the global economy. The Labor Department says U.S. workers were not as productive in the fourth quarter as initially reported. Productivity rose at an annual rate of 1.8% during October, November, and December. That's down from an earlier estimate of 2.8%. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down 270 points. The Nasdaq is down 160. This is NPR. Officials with the Taliban say they are releasing U.S. citizen Dennis Coyle from custody. He's been detained in Afghanistan for more than a year. The Afghan Foreign Ministry says it is acting on a request from Coyle's family and in honor of the Eid al-Fitr holiday. This celebration marks the end of Ramadan. There's a new tax deduction available this filing season. For the first time, some taxpayers will be able to deduct the interest they pay on their car loans. The deduction is only available for new cars bought last year and only if those cars were assembled in the U.S. NPR's Camilla Domonoski explains.
In addition to being restricted to new cars built in the U.S., there's also an income limit. The deduction phases out above $100,000 of modified adjusted gross income or $200,000 for married couples. It's available whether you itemize or not. Mark Gallegos, a tax guy in Chicago, has had to explain to his clients that they won't get any paperwork in the mail about it.
For 2025, there is no tax form that gets sent to you that says, hey, here's your portion of car loan interest that you paid.
The tax change came in last year's One Big Beautiful Bill Act, so there hasn't been time to set up that kind of a process. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Officials in Port Arthur, Texas, have lifted a shelter-in-place order for part of the city. Officials declared that last night after an explosion at a Valero oil refinery in the city. It's on the Gulf, close to the Louisiana border. Port Arthur's mayor says no one was hurt in the explosion. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We had a little technical difficulty at the top of the hour, but we're back and some stories to bring you, including a growing frustration in Parksville, where some residents say they're gone more than 10 days without running water. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But first, Governor Kathy Hochul is facing pushback from climate advocates after proposing changes to New York's landmark climate law. Critics say the plan would delay key emission rules and weaken how the state tracks methane, a move they argue could slow the transition away from fossil fuels and keep energy costs high. And hundreds of advocates are expected in Albany for a rally urging lawmakers to reject the proposal tomorrow. Eric Walker of We Act for Environmental Justice joins us to talk about what's at stake. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
What's your immediate reaction to Governor Hochul's proposed changes to New York's climate law?
Quite frankly, the short version is that the governor continues to try and conflate the climate law with the affordability crisis that millions of New Yorkers are facing right now. And that's just, the numbers just don't add up. It's a false narrative. And we think that what she's offering is not a solution to the law, to the challenges that New Yorkers are facing, but a hollowing of the law to make gas look good.
You described the changes as a hollowing or weakening of the law. What specifically concerns you the most?
I think we're really concerned, about the change to the way that the state accounts its emissions, for example. As you noted, we're an environmental justice organization working in West Harlem with folks who live near some of the dirtiest fossil fuel generating stations in the state. We're constantly exposed to particulate matter that literally kills people every day. And changing the accounting, emissions accounting, doesn't solve that problem at all. Doesn't keep people from dying, doesn't make the air any cleaner. It just makes the math look better.
And what does the delay mean in practical terms when it talks about delaying key emission regulations until 2030? What does that look like for folks?
I think the most significant change for us is delaying a program that would help bring the state's emissions down. For all the reasons that I noted before, we are actually involved in some litigation against the DEC for not having proposed those regulations, and pushing the timeline any further is just really going to put people that we work with and serve on the front lines of both those emissions and put their lives at risk. And it doesn't actually do anything to lower bills. That's the real problem, right? We have a story that says if we change the climate law, everything will go, all your bill problems will go away, and that's just not true. It doesn't address the affordability crisis, and it puts more of our community in harm's way.
And for listeners who don't follow climate policy closely, the one thing that does resonate with them is their bill, their electricity bill, their gas bill, utility bills. How do you expect this proposed change or these proposed changes to impact household utility bills in the short or long term?
Again, both the governor, the legislature, and advocates have all essentially acknowledged that changing the law doesn't bring anybody's bill down today, doesn't bring anybody's bill down long term. What it does is make the math look better so that we can continue to keep our electric system on undergirded by fossil fuels, which is what's actually driving the problem. So fossil fuel price volatility is what's actually making bills go up, because a lot of our electric system is powered by natural gas. The big generators are powered by natural gas. And so when those prices go up, your bill goes up because you pay that differential in your service. And so what we need to do is really get our system off of gas in order to stabilize those prices. And that's the message that we're trying to send to both Governor Hochul and to the legislature.
And what would a more equitable or just energy transition look like from your perspective?
There are a lot of things that we can do. Right now, we know that distributed solar, for example, is both the fastest growing sector of our electric system right now, both in the state and locally, globally, where that's so we need to accelerate the pace of distributed renewables like solar, land-based wind, for example, that are cheap to build, faster to build than natural gas, and certainly faster than the nuclear plan that Governor Hochul's put forward. And so it's cheaper, faster, and brings down bills. That's the first thing we want to talk about in terms of a transition that benefits everyone. Second thing is we want to localize where that energy is. Again, we have members living near really badly emitting peaker plants. And so we want to swap out that emitting generation for non-emitting generation and make sure people are not literally dying every year. Oh, in New York City alone, the Rocky Mountain Institute estimates that nearly 1,900 people die every year from PM2.5 pollution from combustion of fossil fuels. And so that is just, we got to stop that. And I think that that the lives of New Yorkers are worth making sure we accelerate the pace, not slow it down by these hollow changes.
The law was passed in 2019, and in her 11th hour push to change the law, Governor Hochul saying we need more time. Do you buy it?
We think these are kind of self-inflicted wounds. For 5 of the 7 years that this law has been in place, Governor Hochul has been at the helm. We've seen disruption in the supply chains from things like Donald Trump's antagonism to renewable energy. But quite frankly, we think that we could have had distributed renewables, for example, raise the bar sooner, got the ball moving faster to help accelerate the pace of renewables. For 2 years after the state was required to release greenhouse gas emission reduction rules, they basically sat on their hands. And so that's why my organization and others filed a lawsuit to compel action through the courts, which we thankfully received a favorable ruling on in October. And now we're waiting for an appeal process to play out, because the state, again, has demonstrated that its perception of the problem is inaccurate, that it thinks it's too complicated and too hard. And the judges said pretty clearly that hard is not a reason not to follow the law. So we want the state to move forward with getting our state and our economy on the right track to save people money on their bills, get our energy system off of fossil fuels, and follow the law.
Lawmakers in the state assembly and Senate initially rebuffed Governor Hochul's push to change the law in this year's budget, but it seems some may have softened their tone in recent days. What do you think the role of lawmakers is right now in this process? What role should they be playing at this point?
I think the legislature has a really huge responsibility right now to make sure that we don't gut the CLCPA. When it was enacted, a nation-leading climate law, and that the goals of it are both rooted in affordability and rooted in a scientifically based foundation of what we need to do in order to make sure we don't continue to accelerate climate change. And so when we think about the role that the legislature has, they have a huge responsibility to both make sure we maintain affordability, maintain our emissions goals, but they are targets, not wishful thinking. We have to make sure that as we move forward, we're generating the revenue that we need in order to support helping people make that transition. And so making sure that we're on track to lower emissions overall, generate revenue through things like a strong and robust cap and invest program, make sure that we are accelerating renewable energy development across the state are things that I think are really important for the legislature to make sure to keep in mind.
And to make sure they hear you, tomorrow, your organization, along with dozens of climate, health, environmental, and consumer advocacy organizations and regular New Yorkers, are holding an all-day emergency rally at the state capitol in Albany. What do you hope lawmakers hear? What do you want them to hear from this demonstration tomorrow?
Well, we want them to hear what I think everybody understands, right? But we want to, is that New Yorkers can't afford any more delays in the climate law, in implementing the Climate Act. New Yorkers need real solutions to the affordability crisis that New Yorkers are facing. One in four New Yorkers is 60 days or more behind in paying their electric bills, and that's just not acceptable. And we can't hold up a boogeyman of the Climate Act and walk away from the real work that needs to be done in order to lower bills and address our climate change crisis.
And if these changes go through in this budget, what could happen next for this fight?
Well, I think there's a lot of discussion that needs to be had in terms of what. We haven't seen a real proposal from the governor yet. It's been, you know, her negotiating tactic has been to leverage her ideas in the media, and what lawmakers need and what advocates need is to see an actual proposal from the governor's office. We haven't seen one yet. So if we're really serious about trying to make some, you know, modifications to the Climate Act, let's put it on paper. Show us your work. We're really not satisfied with flagging it through the media. It's not how you negotiate. It's not how you get policy made. At the end of the day, you need a piece of paper that people can react to. So I hope that this will mean that the governor will move forward with issuing a proposal that folks can respond to, and we can take it from there.
And for folks who are listening who may not be able to make the rally but are concerned about this, what can they do? How can they make their voice heard?
Yeah, our Renewable Heat Now, which is an organization that we act as a part of, you can send in you can uplift our messaging on social media. I can put out the toolkit here. You can reach us on Renewable Heat Now on Instagram. You can reach WEACT on all of our socials and help support the rally tomorrow.
That is Eric Walker of WEACT for Environmental Justice, speaking to us about the governor's planned changes to New York's landmark climate law and a rally, an all-day rally in Albany tomorrow. Eric, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, going on 11 days without water, and now under a boil water advisory, Parksville residents say they're at a breaking point. More from Kimberly Izar next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org, and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org. Hello, Radio Catskill listeners. This is Andy Carlson, and I'm inviting you to join me Thursday nights for 2 hours of genre-bending exploration of the American rock songbook on Ramble Tamble. I'll be bringing you everything from John Prine to PJ Harvey, Steely Dan to Steppenwolf, and just about everything in between. That's Ramble Tamble, Thursday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Some Parksville residents on Lily Pond Road are now going on 11 days without running water. Yesterday, residents received a boil water notice after they lost their water, but there's no water to boil. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with residents and local officials yesterday and brings us this report.
Judy Freestone lives on Lily Pond Road in Parksville, New York, where she walks me through how her life has changed since she hasn't had water for over a week.
I can't flush the toilet. and I can't run the shower.
The past few days have felt frustrating and even depressing at times, she says.
I'm not functioning. I have to do laundry. I need to take a shower. I'm taking food out because I can't cook and I can't wash dishes. I'm taking my clothes to the laundry. I'm going to my son or my daughter's house to take a shower and grabbing gallons of water when I come back. I'm 76 years old. I don't need this. I do not need this.
Freestone is one of about 10 households that have not had potable running water at Lily Pond Road for anywhere between 2 to 11 days. Lily Pond Road is in a more rural part of the town of Liberty, but the town's water system isn't available up there. So the village of Liberty supplies water to residents, and the residents pay their water bills to the village. Village of Liberty Mayor Joan Stoddard says the water shortage is due to the failure of water pumps at the Elm Street well on March 13th. Since then, they've had to increase their draw from Lily Pond, and that's reduced the water pressure for nearby residents. Until water levels return to normal, she says, there's little help they can offer. So far, Freestone says the only communication she's gotten from the village was a boil water notice she received on Monday.
I really don't know what this is. A gentleman from the water department just gave this to me about a half hour ago. It says boil water notice. It's dated Monday, March 23rd, and it says consumers of Village of Liberty Water Supply should boil all water for drinking and culinary purposes. That's what the notice says. I have no water to boil.
While Lily Pond residents pay their water bill to the village, Mayor Stoddard told Radio Catskill that those residents are considered, quote, outside users, end quote. She says because the homes are located in the town and not the village, they can't spend any village dollars to upgrade their water systems. Outside users, she says, don't have the same rights as village residents. Lily Pond resident Nick Prague disagrees.
They said it's not their responsibility. But they, like I said, they're collecting money from me. May will be 11 years they're collecting money from me for my water.
In his home, Prague has several jugs of water lined against the wall outside of his bathroom for situations like these.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 5. We have 11 gallons of water here that lives here for the purpose of flushing the toilet when village water doesn't allow me to flush.
Prague says he's most worried about his neighbors, the majority of whom are seniors.
I'm a little more fortunate than some. I'm in relatively good health. We have one house, there's a lady there on dialysis with other health problems. Fortunately, the other house, there in Florida right now, she has her health problems. And, you know, they just don't care.
So have you tried reaching out to the village or town?
I've called the village water department several times. I even spoke to Mr. Burke. He said to me last, I'm going to say Tuesday. They're going to fix it Wednesday. Expect the pressure to restore by Thursday.
This was
Last Thursday. And we still don't have anything.
This isn't the first time the area's residents have faced water shortages. Last July, residents say they didn't have water for 2 weeks. Mayor Stoddard said that she advised residents in 2025 to go to the town of Liberty to form a water district. But town of Liberty supervisor Frank DeMeo says he never heard of that idea until about a day ago.
It's not even something that the town ever even discussed because nobody's approached us about that possibility. And it would, you know, again, without doing some additional research, I can't imagine that, you know, for only, say, 10 residents, because I believe that's what they have up there, that a district would be warranted. I mean, it would be very expensive. And if it's true, what I was told by the mayor, that, you know, Lily Pond is too low right now to service these folks, who's to say that even if we had a district up there with a pump station, what if that same situation existed? You know, and we couldn't supply that district with water, which would mean we'd probably have to bring tanker trucks or something up there so that they had some water. And, you know, it would be very, very expensive for the people in the district. We can't burden the overall taxpaying population with something like that. Those would have to be costs that would be borne by the district only. Mm-hmm. And right now, if that district only encompassed 10 users, that's a pretty hefty price tag they'd have to pay.
Some residents, like Margaret Bachman, says she also never received advice from the mayor about building a water district.
I got no such advisement or communication. The only thing that I recall anyone from the water department advising me to do was to get a well. That is incredibly expensive.
Bachman says she's already taken drastic measures to get by.
I can't shower. I feel odd about imposing on friends and asking to take a shower. I have, on at least one occasion, rented a room at the Days Inn just to take a shower. I know that at least one other neighbor has done something similar. I mean, just on a personal, emotional level, I don't sleep very well. I don't know what the future holds. Most of us that are affected right now are seniors. Two of us are recent widows, including myself. It is draining, frankly. It is draining. I go back and forth from wanting to curl up into a ball and cry and just wanting to scream.
As of Tuesday morning, Bachman and others on Lily Pond Road are still waiting for water.
I and all of my neighbors try to do all of the things that we're supposed to do. We pay our taxes. We try to maintain our property. We pay our water bill. And we try to live good lives without hurting anybody. And all I want to do is wash my hands in my own sink. And I don't think that's unreasonable.
In Parksville, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Thanks, Kim, for that report. Coming up, we'll go into the debate over whether Sullivan County should burn trash or focus on recycling and waste reduction instead. The timeline, the hurdles, and the potential impact of a facility that could change how Sullivan County handles waste for years to come. That's next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, it's Callison Stratton. Join me for a special live edition of Liberation Station Friday evening at the Parlor in Narrowsburg. We're celebrating Women's History Month and supporting Radio Catskill with drinks, raffles, and prizes from local women-owned businesses and live music from the Basic Bitches, Eilish, Masha Sokol, and more. $20 suggested donation at the door. Don't miss this live event, 7:30 Friday evening at the Parlor in Narrowsburg.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio. Is it time to start thinking about scamming as an industry?
It is absolutely an industry, a very competitive industry.
We'll hear how the industry works, from getting hold of your data.
Privacy is a myth.
To the economics of the industry and what the scam fighters are doing about it. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Sullivan County is moving forward with plans that could eventually bring a waste-to-energy incinerator to the region. We've told you about this. The county has issued a new request for proposals, looking at a private partner to develop and operate the facility as part of its long-term waste management strategy. County officials say it's about handling trash locally, but environmental groups are raising concerns about pollution, costs, and whether it could actually discourage waste reduction. For more on what's in the proposal, what happens next, and what it could mean for the community, we're joined now by reporter Liam Mayo from The River Reporter. Liam, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
Let's remind folks about this RFP that's out for this waste-to-energy facility, or what some folks also call an incinerator. What would it look like here?
Yeah, so this RFP is out for some kind of public-private partnership that would build a waste-to-energy facility or incinerator in Sullivan County. And the details of like what that technology would be and what the provider would be That's all the kinds of things that would be determined depending on who responds to the RFP and what kind of project they want to bring to the table. But in very broad strokes, the county is looking at something like this, something that would take trash, burn it, liquefy it, do something to turn it into energy, leaving very minimal byproducts as an alternate to what the county is currently doing, which is paying for its trash to go out of state to, or out of the area, excuse me, to a landfill out of the area.
How is this RFP different from the draft version the county released last year?
Yeah, so there was an RFP last year where the county was doing this same thing, looking at or putting out a request for people to submit proposals. And it got a lot of feedback from people in the industry, people who are sort of more looking at this from the environmental side. And according to Josh Potosik, county manager, that was kind of just the first step in this process. That RFP wasn't really looking for actionable things for the legislature to vote on or decide to move forward with. That was more to get feedback and to shape the eventual form that the full official request for proposals will take. Now, the county has now put that official RFP out. It is looking for sort of an official proposal and an official partnership that could potentially, depending on the responses they get, go before the legislature as something the county would move forward with.
And proposals are due by June 5th. County Manager Josh Potosik also mentioned a long timeline in this process. What are some of the key milestones between now and, you know, seeing this possible facility being built?
Yeah, so there are a couple of steps that he mentioned. First, the county needs to see if it gets any proposals back, if there's anyone who's interested in working on the county on this. If there is a proposal that gets back, the Sullivan County Legislature would have to be completely convinced that this is something the county should do and the county should move forward with. So looking at this from a financial perspective, looking at this from an environmental perspective, anything else that the legislators on the county legislature would want as part of this process. After that, if the county legislature votes yes, we want to move forward with this project and with this partner, that contract would be contingent on the partner going to the State Department of Environmental Conservation and getting a permit there. After that, it would take some time to construct the facility. If the DEC even grants a permit, because that's absolutely not a sure thing. So Potosik said, like, you're kind of looking at a decade between now, where we're at in the process, and realistically getting some kind of facility constructed and finished and operational. And that's kind of still not an optimistic timeline, but that's still assuming everything chugs along as it would need to over the next couple of years.
And there's already been pushback and concern among the community. What are some of the main concerns that folks in the community, environmental groups, are raising about this incinerator, proposed incinerator?
Yeah, there are concerns about the presence of an incinerator in the county as a potential health risk to residents around it. For the potential pollution that such a facility could put off. There are concerns about the county's sort of tax burden or the liability the county would insure, especially with going with this kind of technology. And from a more philosophical level, a lot of the things environmentalists are saying is that this is just the wrong approach. There's a letter that's being circulated saying that, quote, waste management is the path, or waste minimization, sorry, is the path we, both Sullivan County and society as a whole, should be taking. We need to rethink / redesign, refuse, reduce, reuse, repair, recycle, and compost more, not less. But an incinerator would demand precisely the opposite, continuing to fuel the linear make-take-waste economic paradigm we have today. So basically, if you build an incinerator, there's an incentive to keep handling trash in the same way that treats of it as trash, that treats of it as something that cannot be minimized, that cannot be recycled or
you know, reused in different ways, it's something that just needs to be chucked somewhere to be getting rid of. And instead of being chucked into a landfill and forgotten about, it would be chucked into an incinerator, which would be an incredibly expensive facility that would require sort of a constant stream of trash to remain economically viable. Mm. When we were speaking with Josh Potosik, he said that he understands this concern, and he, you know, hears that people saying that there is a need to reduce waste, but he, from his perspective, this isn't something Sullivan County can solve on its own. This is something that is a broader societal problem with how much plastic is used in packaging, with the disposability of a lot of things in our culture. He said, quote, "Can we do more on recycling? Yes. Can we compost? Yes. But that's not going to mean waste goes to zero until packaging laws change. Federal, state, municipalities, or anyone trying to get to zero waste, your hands are tied. It's almost impossible." So there's this philosophical difference about the necessity of an incinerator or a landfill or some kind of solution like that versus the other options that are out there to manage the waste that we produce in our day-to-day lives.
I mean, it sounds like it's a larger philosophical debate about waste reduction versus disposal. What is the county's main argument for pursuing this kind of facility right now?
I think right now the county is just looking at it as something that needs to be considered. Recently, or a line that was previously the reason for the county originally looking into this years ago was the idea that landfills are being filled up, and the county's landfill at the time, Seneca Meadows, was very close to reaching capacity, and the county would need to sort of find another solution by the time Seneca Meadows was no longer an option. The county has since switched to another landfill, so it has kind of taken that timeline or that deadline off the table, but there is still this push to consider, like, okay, is this something that would be a responsible way for us to manage our trash going forward? Is this something that even is environmentally friendly? There, in some of the arguments around this, there is a debate about whether, like, incineration is preferable to landfilling as an option, say. So I'm not sure exactly what the current impetus is for pursuing it, but I think overall just the county wants to know whether this is an option and wants to see what kinds of responses it gets back as it's planning out the next 10, 20, 30 years of its waste management strategy.
I want to turn to another story you're reporting on at the River Reporter. The Sullivan County Legislature at their meeting last Thursday authorized $1 million grant application to support a Liberty housing development, but legislators were divided over supporting the project. Let's talk a little bit more about what this proposal is and why were they divided?
Yeah, the proposal was a grant application through this new count or this new statewide program, the County Infrastructure Grant Program, which is a $100 million fund in the fiscal year 2026 New York State budget for county-led infrastructure projects supporting the creation of housing. So this isn't the county itself would be building this housing, but it is partnering with or would be partnering with the Kearney Realty and Development Group to get this funding to help support this project. And the project itself would be at least 70, potentially up to 100 units of workforce or affordable housing on land currently owned by Sullivan County in the town of Liberty. And there was discussion when this came up in the legislature about the process behind this coming to the legislature. The timeline and the turnaround on this was fairly quick, where the county needed to authorize this grant application in order to meet certain deadlines, and there wasn't potentially like the extended timeline to bring this under discussion. I think there was general consensus in the legislature or general recognition from the legislature that affordable housing is something that should be supported, but it's something that or the questions were around whether this is the right location for it, whether this is the right project to support, sort of most vehemently from legislator Brian McPhillips. This would be in the town of Liberty. His district includes part of the town of Liberty.
And he was saying that this is absolutely the wrong location for it. It's the wrong project for that type of location, specifically saying it was sort of too high density for the area of the town where it would be located.
And Mark Baez of the Sullivan County Partnership for Economic Development was there making comments as well, saying that part of this is that you have a deadline for this grant, and sometimes you have to just make the decisions, right?
Yeah, he was saying that, like, yeah, this may have happened fairly quickly going through the legislature, going through the county, but you do need to act when the opportunity presents itself. And what he was saying was that this is a, and why he was there supporting it, was this is a huge part of economic development, is finding places for workers to live in the county. He said that when employees or employers look at the county to bring their businesses to, some of the first questions they ask are, where are their workers going to live? So creating a project like this helps with, or helps answer those questions. And, you know, it's the project that's in front of us. It's not necessarily going to be the perfect location. It's not necessarily going to be the perfect process, but sometimes you get the opportunity to make the choice and you get to say yes or no.
And again, this is just simply applying for the grant. There's no guarantee that they'll get the grant, but you have to move forward to do that, right? And if they get it, the proposed project could begin within 12 months of receiving that grant.
Yeah, absolutely. I think from what legislators were talking about, that the project would have to begin within those 12 months, which was another reason Legislator McPhillips was sort of pulling back a little bit on it, saying that, hey, this project isn't kind of far enough along in its development. It hasn't gone through enough of the regulatory processes that it would need to go through to be convinced that it could actually happen within that time frame. But yeah, this is just the application for the grant. It's not the county itself signing off on this project necessarily. Like, it's not the county itself doesn't have like land use authority or land use decision making. That's stuff that happens at the town level. This is just the county voting yes on this one very specific grant application to fund a part of this overall project.
And does the town of Liberty support the project?
Yeah, there was mention of that. Town of Liberty Supervisor Frank DeMeo told the legislature the town board had met and approved a resolution of support for the project. Legislator McPhillips was pushing back a little bit against that, or against the idea that the town would support it. I think it'll be interesting to see as this develops what kind of reaction there is from broader citizens of the town of Liberty, and just especially as more details about the project develop.
And some of this gets into zoning and high-density housing versus a low-density area. So more to come as this develops. And Liam Mayo from the River Reporter will be keeping tabs on that and more. You can find his reporting at riverreporter.com. Liam, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, fraud targeting Medicare recipients, offering free medical equipment, then billing Medicare without consent. We'll learn more about this scam and how to avoid it coming up. This is Radio Chatskill.
Farmers have tended to support President Trump politically, but his tariffs, immigration policies, and war in Iran are hurting their bottom lines.
They're choking us. We are getting choked out here. This is not going to end well.
Is it painful enough to move this loyal voting bloc away from Trump? That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen to All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Feel like you're just spinning in an endless whirlpool of information? We can help steady you. I'm Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media, and we point out where you should be paying attention and what you can afford to ignore. Using the media as a lens on our world, we reveal nuance and detail often missed by other outlets. So don't miss On the Media, Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, a warning for Medicare recipients: scammers posing as doctors or Medicare representatives are offering so-called free braces and medical equipment, then using stolen information to bill for items that patients never ordered. It's the latest fraud of the month from the New York Statewide Senior Action Council. Executive Director Maria Alvarez joins us now to talk about how to protect yourself. Maria, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Tim. It's so nice to hear from you again.
Well, it's nice to hear from you, and I always enjoy hearing from you. But then also on the other side of it, I hate that we have to talk about this. That just means these scams keep going, but I'm glad you guys are there.
It's such a mixed message, yes.
I'm glad you guys are there keeping a watch on this at the New York Statewide Senior Action Council. So for listeners hearing about this maybe for the first time, what is durable medical equipment or DME fraud?
So, first of all, durable medical equipment are things like back braces, knee braces, any type of equipment that is sent that is used for your medical purposes, glucose monitors, things like that. And the fraud is that basically people the bottom line is that people are getting charged. Are charging Medicare on their account, on Medicare beneficiaries' accounts, durable medical equipment that is either not prescribed by a legitimate doctor or the doctor that the person, you know, goes to, or it's being prescribed and it's not, and the medical equipment is not coming to their home at all. So, it's a fraud either way, whether they receive the equipment or not. It's being charged to Medicare.
How common is this type of fraud in New York and across the country?
Well, it comes in and out of phases. So, these fraudsters seem to have trends. And in the past, what they would do would they would call a person, a Medicare beneficiary, and convince them to accept what they called a free, let's say, back brace, and when it free meaning that they would have to give up their Medicare number because Medicare would be charged. They weren't charging the patient; they were charging Medicare. So then, what would happen is people would receive a back brace or whatever equipment, and it wasn't their doctor who was charging it, and they may not have even needed this type of equipment. But now what's happening is that the fraudsters may have part of your information, and what they're looking for is confirmation, right? So they're looking for you to confirm that this is your Medicare number, and they'll call you. They seem familiar with your situation. They may know they may want to discuss your medications or what treatments you're receiving, and then they will then prescribe or not even prescribe. They'll just send you the equipment, and sometimes they won't even send the equipment, but they will definitely charge Medicare. So it's coming. It's becoming quite frequent again because, again, it just goes through different trends, and so more and more people are saying, "I received this in the mail. I did not order it," or they're looking at their Medicare statement notices, which is how you probably will find out that this is happening to you, and they'll say, "I didn't get the equipment," or "My doctor. This is not a doctor that I go to. So how did I get this?"
We've talked before, and people, I think, are trying to be more alert when it comes to protecting their personal information. But as you mentioned, sometimes they already have a portion of your information. How are they getting it?
Well, the problem is that over the internet, there are so many things that people can glean, and these fraudsters, the same way that you and I wake up every day to do this type of work, the fraudster's job is to defraud you of your information. So they've become very, very tricky and very astute, And what they do is they cobble together different pieces of information. And when they call you, it's basically to confirm that all of these things are exactly you. So they'll want your ad. They seem to know that, you know, your address. They seem to know that this is your doctor. They may know what type of medication you take or your pharmacy. So then that they call you from a phone that has, if you have caller ID, that looks like your doctor's office or Medicare even. And then what happens is when they call you with all of this information, they sort of lull people into the confidence that this is a legitimate person, and then we end up confirming things without even realizing it. So the best thing to do is not give out any information over the phone unless you're making that call, unless you are talking to at the telephone number that you know and that you're confident that who you are speaking to is somebody who you trust, like your doctor.
Do you hear from victims of fraud like this? What are they telling you? What's the real impact on them?
Well, there's a couple of problems. One is that if on your record, for example, on your Medicare record, it shows up that Medicare has paid, let's say, for a back brace or a wheelchair, right, that they have paid for, and it wasn't to a legitimate source, on the day that you need it and that your doctor is prescribing it, and you say, I definitely need a back brace or a wheelchair, Medicare is going to deny it. Going to deny the claim because they will say, well, we've already paid for this, so we can't pay for a second one. So that's one impact that that people are not going to be able to receive the services that they need. Number two, costs will go up in insurance, right? Because all of this fraudulent activity costs the taxpayer over $100 billion a year. And then for your own medical records, things that are not true are going to appear on your medical records. So it can be very, very dangerous to not correct things that are not right on your Medicare records.
Let's talk about red flags and prevention. You mentioned your Medicare records. How important is it to regularly review Medicare summary notices, and what should people look for?
Well, that is paramount to all of this because, for example, in this case of this new durable medical equipment scam, many people do not find out that somebody has their Medicare number unless they look at the Medicare summary notice. So if you look at your summary notice and you don't recognize the doctor, if you don't recognize the treatment, if you don't recognize, you know, anything that something that doesn't appear on your record, you should either call the doctor's office, call the insurance company, call Medicare, or call the Medicare Senior Patrol. So that way we could you could rectify this because you don't want to keep that on your record.
And if free equipment, quote unquote, shows up at somebody's door but they didn't order it, what should they do?
They should not accept it, number one. But number two, if it's let's say sometimes they just leave it there, right? Take a picture of it and call us. If you just call the New York State Senior Medicare Patrol, our counselors are trained to help people with this issue.
And let's be very clear. Will Medicare ever call and offer free equipment?
Of course not. Medicare is in the business of paying things that have been billed to them. They never call to offer anything, and they don't call you at all. So the key is never give out your Medicare number.
And if someone does do that, though, they give out their Medicare number, what should they do right away?
Oh, they should call the New York State Senior Medicare Patrol so that we could help them rectify that.
And let's remind folks that number and how they can get in touch with the Senior Patrol and the New York Statewide Senior Actions Council.
They could call 800-333-4374. 800-333-4374.
And the website is nyseniors.org. Maria, do you want to let folks know a little bit more about some of the other services you provide for seniors?
Yes, we are a 54-year-old community-based organization. So we've been providing services such as assistance with healthcare navigation, such as Medicare, you know, insurance, prescription drugs, and patients' rights services. So what we do is we help people. We give people the best information that they can have for their current situation and where they live, and so that people can make the best decisions about their own health care as possible. So our services are completely free and unbiased, meaning that we're not here to sell you anything. What we're here is to give you information so that you can make the best decisions for your loved ones and for yourself.
And on March 31st, you have a webinar coming up, a patient advocate program teach-in about Medicare Advantage plans. What's that webinar about? How could that help folks?
Oh, yes. Well, we have monthly teach-ins, and we have different topics. This month, we are talking about Medicare Advantage plans and the observation status, how the Medicare Advantage plans can waive the 3-day notice, which is a person, in order to get you know, certain services such as rehab, you know, services, usually you have to be in the hospital, admitted into the hospital for 3 nights, it's very impactful, because what happens is, if you're not admitted into the hospital for 3 nights, Medicare would not pay. But these Medicare Advantage plans have the ability to waive those 3 nights so that people can get the proper care in a rehab center without having to pay for it themselves out of pocket. And so so we're going to talk about that on that day.
It's March 31st at 10, and you can register for that. It's free, but registration is required, and you can go to nyseniors.org to learn about
Absolutely.
That. And all the
and
other,
May,
yeah.
Yeah, and on May 11th, we're going to have a grassroots day in Albany, and that would be a great time for people to come and you know, we're going to meet with our elected officials all about issues concerning seniors. You know, senior citizens 65 and over are 20% of the population. We need to make sure that the services are there to be able to support this population, and sometimes funding is not the biggest priority in government. So we want to make sure that our services are covered.
Yep. Senior Grassroots Day, May 11th. Registration required by May 1st. And transportation available. You may, if you need a ride to Albany,
yes,
you might be able to get one there from.
Yes, you need to let us know, and we're happy to accommodate people. And there's lunch and everything. So, yes.
That's Maria Alvarez, Executive Director of the New York Statewide Senior Action Council. Again, nyseniors.org is the website. The number is 800-333-4374. Maria, thank you so much for joining us and for keeping a close eye on all of our seniors.
Thank you so much, Tim, and I look forward to speaking to you soon.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can sign up for our weekly newsletter. It's free at wjffradio.org. Find out the latest news and information and events going on from Radio Catskill at wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Vintage House, selling vintage clothing, records, books, and toys from the past. A walk back in time on Main Street in Jeffersonville. And at vintagehousejville.com. And from listeners like you.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, I speak with iconic feminist, organizer, and a leader in the American labor movement, Dolores Huerta. It's the first interview she gave after the New York Times revealed the sexual assault allegations against Cesar Chavez. That's this week on Latino USA. Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, partly sunny, not as cold, high 44, 26 for a low tonight, a little warmer tomorrow, a high of 48 under mostly cloudy skies. We may see a passing shower or two in the evening. Thursday's high, noticeably warmer, 64 with a couple of afternoon showers, cooling down a bit Friday and into the weekend. But let's enjoy the sunshine now. On Point is next.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.